So welcome, everyone, to this podcast edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This is a program you're going to like. Joe Lovell from Amarillo, Texas, a lawyer, friend, survivor of the Wendover Death March, the summer tours. And you know, here's what I liked about this program. It is, you're a serious guy. You know, when we're out on the trail, you can play with the best of them. And you are lighthearted, and you love to laugh, and you're sarcastic, and so on. But when you get talking about this subject, trial by jury, and the threat to trial by jury, in our time, you're deeply serious.
I am. I think it is crucial, like Mr. Jefferson. I think it is a crucial component of our Democratic Republic, and without it, we are going to lose, citizens are going to lose something, and they just don't know what they're losing.
Because in the pop cultural world, the sense we get is O.J. Simpson, and it's madness, it's chaos, the system's broken, it's all hyper-dramatized. You're saying that day in and day out across this country, if there is a jury of peers, justice is usually done, that the citizens who come in, however unwilling they are, rise to the occasion, that it's a pretty magical part of the American system.
Yes.
And almost uniquely American.
That is correct. Even Great Britain has whittled down. That's where we got the right to trial by jury, and they've whittled it down to where it's almost non-existent there.
So this is, I think, a really interesting program. I'm glad you're here. I think you should come back and talk about other constitutional systems, and particularly America's continuing search for justice, because you're in the trenches. You actually see what this looks like. This is not just civics to you. This is about your profession, but something bigger than that too. It's about justice in the United States, and if you're right, and I'd have no reason to doubt you, that effectively money is distorting the system the way it distorts almost everything else, and that in the kinds of arbitration agreements that we're entering into, people are basically jettisoning their constitutional rights for a system that's proposed to be more streamlined and so on and so forth, but actually doesn't serve justice as well.
That's true. The right to trial by jury is like an ambulance. Nobody needs one until they need one, and then when they need one, they really, really, really need one. And that's part of the problem, is we actually live a pretty good life in this country where it's rare, in fact, for people to need to access the courts, and particularly to access a jury. But wow, people who have been through it, they come out of it and they really, really realize how important that was.
So listen now to this special edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour featuring my friend Joe Lovell of Amarillo, Texas. And the subject today is the Bill of Rights, but particularly Bill number 7, the right to trial by jury in civil cases. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, brought to you by Bismarck State College on the banks of the Missouri River at the heart of the Lewis and Clark Trail.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar, author, and creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. But seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good to see you, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, we have a special guest that has come to join the conversation this week, Mr. Joe Lovell, and he is here from Texas, and he would like to speak to you about the Bill of Rights. So I present to you, Mr. President, Joe Lovell.
Good day, Mr. President, and thank you so much for having me here to visit with you.
Well, good day to you. Of course, you know, Texas had a particular resonance in my mind because when I made the Louisiana Purchase, doubling the size of the United States, it wasn't quite clear to anybody where the southwestern border was, where where our border with Spain was. Some thought that it was the Rio Colorado. Others thought that it should be the Rio Grande, the Sabine River. It was a mystery. And we, of course, wanted to read the Louisiana Treaty in the broadest possible way with respect to geography. The Spanish wanted to read it in the narrowest possible way. And in a sense, the next 50 or 60 years of Texas history are about that dispute. I didn't really even know the basic rhythms and geography and fertility of Texas, but I did send a Red River expedition, the Freeman Custis expedition, during my term as president to try to find out, at least in a preliminary way, how the lay of the land worked for the future of the United States. Perhaps you can clear this up.
I'm from Amarillo, Texas, which is in the portion of Texas, the High Plains, in an area that, by most of the maps I've seen, was included in the original Louisiana Purchase. I believe it was traded away then in a treaty with Spain that left us then the Texas we see in other maps that actually goes up into Wyoming.
Well, that map that has the belly of Texas, but then this long stovepipe that goes deep into what's now Wyoming, that at one point that was part of Texas.
Yes, sir. That's correct. And then as you were saying, there were negotiations during your lifetime with Spain to try to work out just what was Texas and what was Louisiana.
They did not want to give up very much. The British had some claims in the northwestern section of the Louisiana Purchase on the Minnesota line, but they were reasonable about it, and we were able to settle things with Britain in 1818 after my presidency. But the Texas issues went on for decades, because Texas was, as I understand it, you're a Texan, I'm not, but Texas had declared its own independence of New Spain, and so it was sort of in a limbo. It was not yet annexed by the United States. It was still culturally part of the Spanish Empire, but it had separated itself out as an independent republic.
That's correct. Now, the portion of Texas I'm from, frankly, is much like where the barn is here in North Dakota.
So you're comfortable here in the barn?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I grew up around cattle, not sheep, but cattle. So it fits right in.
Well, I'm afraid your accent, I don't know how you would characterize your accent, but it does seem to be disturbing the dairy cattle just a little. How would you describe your accent?
I would describe my accent as West Texan.
West Texan. And how did it develop? From where? I mean, Virginia had an accent, and Georgia had an accent, and New Hampshire had an accent. How did this emerge?
I think it's largely Southern. My observation, anyway, largely Southern. Texas was mostly populated historically, at least after the Indians. It was populated by Southerners. And I know my family on both sides are Southerners from various states.
Well, the Austins and the Houstons of early Texas were Tennesseans, weren't they?
Largely. That's correct. So I think that a West Texas accent has a harder edge to it. To me, it's similar to the distinction now that we have between what people would think of as a British accent versus the accent of Australia. The Australians, to me, have a harder...
A harder edge. And you're saying
yes.
That's what you West Texans have?
That's what I believe, yes, sir.
I see. And you quickly mentioned Indians, but say something about the policy towards native peoples of the independent Republic of Texas.
Well, the policy of the Republic of Texas was pretty simple, and that was that they were going to drive the Indians out of the Republic, period. And they were successful in doing so.
Simply didn't want Indians in the Republic.
That is correct.
And to push them out, if possible, exterminate if necessary.
That's true. And in fact, the Indian problem historically was what brought the Anglo-Celtic Americans into Texas to begin with, was the Spanish didn't know how to deal with the Plains tribes of Texas, particularly Comanches and Kiowas, and so then brought in Stephen F. Austin and his family, for example, were given large land grants, and the whole purpose was to develop a boundary, a buffer zone between the Spanish holdings to the south and the raiding Plains tribes of the north and west.
So our colonists were given land grants. I think they were required to profess Catholicism and a few other things, but they were given large land grants. But the intention was to have a buffer between America proper and Spanish Texas, but also to deal with these nomadic tribes.
That's correct.
I see. So how is it that Texas was able to become a state without agreeing to the conditions that most other states had to agree to? Aren't there provisions that make Texas unique?
Yes, and I think it's because Texas was a republic and had its own development of its laws, and you know, it had its own revolution, all of which was very similar to the revolution that you were a part of. But we came in as our own republic and had the ability to dictate terms that others did not, that came in as territories.
And the terminus was eventually set at the Rio Grande.
Eventually. Now, that was something that took a long time to settle. Mexico believed, I think it was at the Nueces, whereas Texas and then later the United States claimed to the Rio Grande.
And this all involved not just diplomatic negotiations, but war.
There was some of that, yes, sir.
What a heritage. You know, really the only thing I know about Texas in my own time was a man named Philip Nolan. Do you know that name?
I do. I've read of him. And so the Mustanger.
He would cross over from the New Orleans area into Texas, East Texas, and get mavericks, get lost horses, buy horses sometimes from Indians, and then bring them back to New Orleans and then sell them, because what would happen is that somebody who lived up in Western Virginia would bring a bateau of wheat or sheep down the Ohio and then the Mississippi River to market, get to New Orleans. That boat, that barge or keelboat, is now worthless. They would either break it up for lumber or sell it. Now they had to get back to Pittsburgh. And so they would either take a boat all the way around Florida and up the East Coast, but that's very expensive, or they would buy horses from this Nolan and go overland on the Natchez Trace up to Nashville and then overland again to Virginia. And so he had a thriving horse raiding trade that made him a colorful figure. Do Texans celebrate him?
No. Interestingly enough, I learned of him on this program.
Well, there you have it. So, interesting. So Texas has a unique place in American life, does it not?
I think it does, yes.
I mean, so there are states like Arkansas or South Dakota or Maryland that, you know, people think well of and they have a history and so on. But then there are larger-than-life states that somehow have their own character and almost their own destiny, and certainly one of those would be Texas.
I believe that's true. Texas, to me, and I hate to use this term for the state of Texas, but I view it as a microcosm of the United States because it has a similar history and it has a similar attitude and similar viewpoint. When you look at Texas as to the United States versus the United States as to the rest of the world.
Now, just to finish this short discussion, your state has produced a president.
More than one.
Which presidents have come from the state of Texas?
Lyndon Johnson and George W. Bush.
So George W. Bush, I take it he's the John Quincy Adams. He's the son of the older Bush.
Yes, who also, not originally, but he also lived and still lives in Texas.
His political life came from Texas.
That's correct.
So you could actually claim three presidents in American history.
I believe that's true, yes.
All 20th century, 21st century presidents.
Correct.
And who was the greatest of them?
Depends on your definition of greatest, but to me, the one who made the most lasting difference in the United States as we know it today would be Lyndon Johnson.
And what were his dates, more or less?
That would have been from 1963, I believe, to 1968.
We need to take a short break. We're talking with our guest host, Mr. Joe Lovell, of the Panhandle of Texas. When we come back, I think you'll be asking me questions about
the Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights. So you're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. This week we are speaking with President Thomas Jefferson about the Bill of Rights. Mr. President, while you were not present at the Constitutional Convention, you argued strongly for the inclusion of a Bill of Rights. You wrote to Mr. Madison and several others that you were critical of the results from the Constitutional Convention and of the Constitution because it did not include a Bill of Rights, which you defined as one that protects freedom of religion, freedom of the press, protection against standing armies, restrictions against monopolies, and the eternal, unremitting force of habeas corpus laws and trials by jury in all matters of fact tribal by the laws of the land. Why was it that you believed it was so important to include a Bill of Rights in the Constitution?
I think it's vitally important. And there I was in Europe, a long way from Philadelphia. The lines of communication were very weak and endlessly long. And the men who met in Philadelphia, the 55 demigods, as I called them, had created a gag rule. They had created a rule of secrecy that they would not divulge outside that hall the deliberations that were going on inside. And so even my closest friend, James Madison, who was my political collaborator all of my life, my confidant, and my partner in the American Republican system of government, even Madison wouldn't tell me in letters what was proceeding behind closed doors. He was true to the commitment of silence that he had made. And so I kept waiting to see what it was that they had produced. I was fascinated by this collection of geniuses, really the greatest collection of mind in the history of the New World, certainly, and what sort of government they would produce for us. Well, when they finally broke up on the 18th of September, 1787, three of them sent me the Constitution immediately. Dr. Franklin, George Washington, who had been the president of the proceedings, and James Madison. And I received them all at about the same time, 6 weeks or so later. And when I read the new Constitution, I was appalled that it did not contain a charter of the rights of man. You know, we lived in the age of the rights of man when we, for the first time, understood that humans are born with rights. They're not granted rights by governments. We're born with certain rights, and to enumerate them and to protect them and to champion them is, in a sense, the whole business of government. Government is essentially a negative business. We declare things that government must never try to do. There are areas that government must never intrude upon. There are parts of our lives that in which we are entitled by natural law to be utterly left alone. And so a Bill of Rights, it serves that function. And I had just assumed that they would begin with a Charter of Rights, or certainly they would append one to the document. They did not. And when I read this and realized that they had enumerated other powers of government, that it could coin money and raise troops and declare war and contract alliances, that it could create a court system, that there would be a tripartite system of national government, legislative, judicial, executive, that elections would occur on such and such a time, and the Electoral College would stand between the people and their government, and so on. Here was all this work to create a process under which we could govern ourselves, and yet at the heart of it, there should have been a Charter of Human Rights, because I regard that as more important than what day you inaugurate the new president, whether it's the 4th of March or the 4th of January. I was flabbergasted, really. I couldn't understand it. I later learned that the men who created the Constitution were tired by the time they finished, and there was a brief discussion of a Bill of Rights, and it was just regarded as too big an undertaking at too late a date with too great exhaustion amongst the Founding Fathers. But I have to say, I was only angry two or three times in the whole course of my life, and this was one of them, to think that our experimental republic could sit down and deliberately produce a constitution designed for a long time and fail to enshrine the rights of man in it. I must make one adjustment to what I've said. Habeas corpus was prohibited in the Constitution because it had been such an abuse in the history of Great Britain. And the Constitution says that there can be no titles of nobility. And the Constitution says that there can be no ex post facto laws. So those three amount to the embedded Bill of Rights in the Constitution, but it wasn't nearly enough. And I just have to say, I was very surprised and deeply disappointed.
Well, of course, your viewpoint ultimately prevailed, but you're mostly known now for the Declaration of Independence.
Correct, yes.
However, if you would permit me, you also said some things in your first inaugural address about the Bill of Rights. And if I can quote you, sir.
Please, sir.
What you deemed essential principles of our government, including those that you advocated for in the Bill of Rights, included, and I quote, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and freedom of person under the protection of habeas corpus, and trial by juries impartially selected. These principles form the bright constellation which has gone before us and guided our steps through an age of revolution and reformation. The wisdom of our sages and blood of our heroes have been devoted to their attainment. They should be the creed of our political faith, the text of civil instruction, the touchstone by which we try the services of those we trust, and should we wander from them in moments of error or of alarm, let us hasten to retrace our steps and to regain the road which alone leads to peace, liberty, and safety. Do you believe, Mr. President, that our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, allows that those rights protected in the Bill of Rights to be eliminated by contract?
No.
Why?
Because they're absolute. Because the Founding Fathers, even in afterthought, enshrined these rights. The Constitution enables certain powers. It enumerates certain things that government can do. Now the Bill of Rights is a sort of counterweight, and so these are things that government must never do. And so you can't contract these away. If you disliked some provision of the Bill of Rights, let's say that in your time the provision prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment seemed to you to be an obstruction to justice. The only way you can change that is through another constitutional amendment. It has constitutional status. It's deeply woven into the American jurisprudence system. The only way you could make an adjustment on it would be a clarifying or countering amendment. And I think you know how difficult an amendment is to pass in the United States. So these are very sacred prohibitions against the powers of government, and nobody has the right to contract away from them, even when it makes sense. I mean, even if we could prove, for example, that registering guns would be a very good idea, or confiscating them from a rebellious state like Texas, that can't be done because the provision in the Second Amendment is so clear and so deeply rooted in our national history.
As one lawyer to another, I would like to focus on the Seventh Amendment.
The Seventh.
Which guarantees the right to trial by jury in civil matters.
All right.
Why did you believe that jury trial in civil matters was important enough to enshrine in the Bill of Rights?
I should begin by saying that I did not write the Bill of Rights. I was still in Europe. It was my dearest friend, James Madison, who wrote the Bill of Rights. He had been partly persuaded by me in my firm letters from France about this, but the American people also made it clear. The American people were not really enamored of the new Constitution. They felt that it was too strong. They feared the centralization of the American government. They feared that their own state sovereignties would be swallowed up. They feared that the government would have the powers to tax beyond its legitimacy. And so there was widespread distaste for the draft of the Constitution that emerged from Philadelphia in the fall of 1787. And if there had been a national plebiscite in which all of the 4 million Americans had been enabled to vote, I believe that the Constitution would not have been ratified. It was ratified in a state-by-state way by ratification procedures. I won't say they were rigged, but they were crafted to make it maximally possible that they would be ratified. And even then, it was difficult. And in several states, North Carolina and Virginia were two of them, the people made it clear that they were ratifying with the promise that a Bill of Rights would come. Now, I actually suggested to North Carolina that they not ratify and say, come back when you have a Bill of Rights. In the end, North Carolina ratified with the hope that there would be a Bill of Rights. And so the people spoke. It wasn't just my own correspondence with Mr. Madison. He then, in the first Congress of the United States, put together I think, 18 bills in a Bill of Rights. Congress passed 12 of them. 10 of them were ratified by December 15, 1791. So the Bill of Rights was an afterthought. It was undertaken by James Madison. Congress didn't take it as seriously as perhaps they should have. There was less debate about these things than probably would have been more useful, given the long-term importance of your Bill of Rights. But Mr. Madison fulfilled his promise and gave the American people a Charter of the Rights of Man. So in the seventh trial by jury of one's peers in civil cases, I think the sense was that as long as we are surrounded by our peers, they are going to be a watchdog on miscarriages of justice. If you think of the history of British justice, you have one very powerful lord where citizens come to try to get justice in civil cases. That lord is an extensive property owner. He resides in a certain part of Great Britain. He has wild prejudices against parts of his own constituency. There's no one watching what he does. His word is final. I think whenever you have power concentrated into the hands of one, it can be abusive. But if you diffuse power into the hands of the many, there are checks against the illogic or the prejudices of a single individual. And so whenever there's a jury in the room, the jury is a guarantee that the ways that average people see the world will have representation in that court. I actually, in criminal cases, believe that a jury has modest rights of jury nullification. I know that's regarded as heresy in your business, you're a lawyer, but I believe that the jury should not be confined merely to questions of fact. That's their primary duty. Did he or did he not murder his neighbor? But I believe the jury should have modest capacity for jury nullification to determine questions of law and severity of punishment, because I don't trust any single individual, any judge, any justice, to be able to keep his mind clear and balanced on all these questions of such great import.
Now, you've downplayed your role in the ultimate adoption of the Seventh Amendment into the Bill of Rights, but in fact, you were a very forceful advocate of that, writing to various congressmen, including Mr. Madison, writing to those overseas. You told Thomas Paine, in connection with the developing French Revolution, that trial by jury, you called it the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution.
Of course.
And you were a man who didn't just reach opinions or jump to conclusions. You were a man who studied things very carefully to reach your conclusions. Could you tell us what formed your strong belief about the importance of this right of trial by jury?
It goes to habeas corpus, too. It goes to the roots of the American Revolution. So let's say that James Monroe is captured by the British troops and they accuse him of terrorism, of torture, of some terrible crime. They would then transport him across the Atlantic Ocean to England. He wouldn't be tried in his own community. He would be transported 3,000 miles to a Star Chamber court in England. There's no habeas corpus. He disappeared. One day he's in Charlottesville. We see some troops roughing him up. He disappears. He's never seen again. It's arguable that he would never be seen again. This happened over and over again in the history of absolutism. So habeas corpus, great breakthrough in the law, says you have to produce the body. You have to show us that he's still alive. We have to have access to him. You must display him as a person who is still alive and reasonably healthy. That's number one. Then the judge in these cases is often a star chamber jurist who hates America, who hates James Monroe, who hates revolution, who hates colonial activity. He alone then sits in judgment over the future of this young man. Once you bring in a jury, they are going to be watching that judge, watching the procedures, watching the way the court unfolds its decisions, and they're going to, in some sense, be protecting the integrity of the process. And in the end, if it's done right, they are going to be the ones that to decide whether he is guilty or innocent. Exceedingly important.
Mr. President, we need to take a short break, but we'll be right back in just a moment. When we return, we'll be speaking with the creator of the Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This is Clay Jenkinson, the creator of the Jefferson Hour, sitting across from my friend Joe Lovell of Amarillo, Texas, in the Panhandle. So what brings you to Dakota du Nord? You know, I think of you up in the Panhandle doing God's work in the judicial system.
Well, I am doing some God's work up in North Dakota in the judicial system.
So welcome. It's a long way up the Great Plains. I trust you didn't drive.
Actually, I did.
You drove.
I did.
This has been one of my dreams. This is a McMurtry dream, you know, is to start. You started in Amarillo.
I did.
And you drove up. What was your route, and how long did it take?
Well, I worked my way up.
As a cotton picker.
Well, no, I worked my way up the plains.
All right.
And I have to tell you, the real reason I drove, or the ultimate reason I drove, was the cost of rental cars in Billings, Montana, because that's where I had to be for depositions. But it gave me a good excuse to drive. I love driving. I love the plains. I've done it a few times. When I came up, I've got a son, daughter-in-law, and two precious little granddaughters who live in Denver. So we stopped there. I actually brought my other son with me, and from Denver, we drove up to Billings and actually spent a few days fishing, then went and worked, then came here for this.
So one of your sons, I know, is a roustabout out in Wild Montana, whitewater raft guide. And
he's a proud river rat.
A young Adonis out on the river for some of the tours that I take and you have been on. So, all right, so you've made this kind of loopy Great Plains auto trip.
I did.
When you drive the plains that way, give me some highlights of how, you know, the land and the plains are not monotone. They're very different types of landscape.
Actually, they are, and you can see them. That's what I like. You know, every place has its own beauty. But if you want to see the beauty of Louisiana, you're not going to see it from a windshield. You have to get out and slop around in it to see the beauty of Louisiana. But out here, and where I'm from, you can step out and you can see many miles. You can see the texture of the land. you can see the sky. And I love it.
What do you love? I mean, give us some highlights. I'll give you one. Sand hills of Nebraska, extraordinarily unusual configuration. Sort of the work of Maurice Sandoz, the great writer, but recently have been in the news because of the possibility that the Keystone would have gone through them. What else do you notice as you make this immense drive?
Well, I think the parts perhaps I like best are what I call the transitional country, which is not to the mountains yet, but not way out on the plains either. And there's a lot of transition in that type of country. There's some mountains, canyons, there's rivers. And for example, I was noticing a lot when I was driving through eastern Montana, and I did not take the interstate, by the way. I went up on Highway 200.
200 is a magnificent road.
It is, in fact, now that I've been on it. But one thing I was noticing is, the land is similar to the land where I'm from, except the colors. Where I'm from, we have a lot more colors in the bluffs. Here it's more bentonite, so it's more gray. But it's very similar, and it's very, very interesting to me.
Interesting. So you drive in the country, you take 200 across Montana. You know, when I take 200 across Montana, sometimes I stop the car. And even if it's the summer, when you turn that key off, you sort of have to realize, I hope this car will start. Because you are in the middle of the middle of the middle of the middle of nowhere. It is endless prairie in every direction. I think maybe the best of the Great Plains in terms of the endless, slightly rolling hills is right there at the heart of east central Montana on Highway 200. That's about as lost as you can get in this country.
I agree. The term that just rang through my head as I was driving on Highway 200 was vast.
Vast.
Everything is vast in eastern Montana.
It is, and empty, because you drive 60 miles to a town that has two bars and a gas station and then seven abandoned buildings and maybe a school, if they still have one, but maybe it's a consolidated school somewhere else. And on the walls you see these dire warnings about meth. I mean, it's meth. Methamphetamines everywhere. There's a sense that this crisis is destroying what's left of this part of rural America. But the landscape and the views are just absolutely breathtaking. And you're an old Lewis and Clark guy. Just imagine if the bison were still out there.
Oh, I know, and I think about that a lot. Actually, there was one scene where I suspect it was cattle I was seeing way, way, way out in the distance. But there were a lot of them. And they were closely grouped, and that's what I thought of.
You imagined bison.
I do. To me, you know, we all talk about if you could go any place in history for just a moment and see something, what would it be? And for me, it would be out on the Great Plains to see one of these massive free bison herds on the Great Plains of America.
Me too, my friend. When I think about this, I have a long list, as I'm sure you do, but almost number one is to see Montana before we did to it what we've done to it, when there were millions of buffalo, grizzly bears, wolves, elk, bighorn sheep, pronghorn antelope, coyotes. It's sometimes referred to as a multiple species association, where you have this kind of Garden of Eden effect, where all these animals, some of which are predators, kind of live in an uneasy harmony because the abundance is so great. That was the Great Plains at the time that Lewis and Clark came through, and between 1804 and 1890, we essentially wiped out everything, including native peoples, and turned it into a platform for till agriculture, which failed. And then we sort of retreated and made it a kind of a mixed prairie of till agriculture under certain conditions and grazing. but you and I can never see it as it was. You can see it through the eyes of Meriwether Lewis, but it would have been something. I'll give you another one. It's a little kind of wackier, perhaps. I would give almost anything to have seen a nuclear test in Nevada when they still did them. That must have been something. I know from people who did see them that they would, the people who live, say, in Reno would get a notice that on Saturday at 10 a.m., if you go out and look south, they'd climb up on mountains and look to the south, and the proving grounds were hundreds of miles away, and yet they could see the nuclear flash in the distance. That must have been something.
I don't know that that, of course, at that time, it probably didn't carry the level of fear
that
it would now.
So, of course, the downwinders have a very different attitude towards. So let me ask you this. The guest chooses the topic. Why did you choose the Bill of Rights, and why in particular did the Seventh appeal to you?
Well, obviously, I'm a trial lawyer, so I live and breathe and have dedicated my adult career to the Seventh Amendment. But also, the pervasiveness of, I asked the question about whether or not you could contract away your civil rights. And that is, in fact, what we've done in this country.
Explain.
Arbitration clauses and various other waiver provisions that are built into essentially everything we do now.
Why have they been built in, and what is their purpose?
I think, well, their purpose is to eliminate access to the courts and eliminate trial by jury. And frankly, to it allows parties with more economic power to have more power over what happens in dispute resolution. But it's become so pervasive, it is everywhere.
Is it done because the courts are clogged and they're expensive?
No. It's done because primarily business, but also areas of government, schools, they want to be able to have more control over what ends up happening and be able to make it harder for somebody else to come in and prevail in a dispute.
So did Jefferson's responses satisfy you?
It didn't surprise me. I mean, yes, it satisfied me. Unfortunately, his viewpoint on being able to contract away constitutional rights has not prevailed.
So Jefferson truly believed that the jury was one of the four or five greatest achievements of Western civilization.
Right.
And I think you think so, too.
I do. You talk about American exceptionalism. And with respect to jury trial, that is literally true. There is almost zero jury trial anywhere else in the world except in the United States. And yet that's now going away from us.
And it's going away from us because power and influence are trying to destroy it?
Partially, yes. Partially.
So, you know, in the wake of the O.J. Simpson trial, and now this wildlife refuge trial up in Oregon, I think the average American who pays any attention to this thinks juries are throwing the dice. It's not this, they're not even just throwing the dice. The juries are very problematic way of going about simple justice. I know you don't think that's true, but you see where the public's perception is.
Sure. Of course, that's the media has a lot to do with that and the influence of the media on jury trials. And we saw that in spades with the O.J. case. But in practice, in reality, outside of the TV cameras, everyday jury trials, that's a different matter. And it really does have the effect that Jefferson and the others intended.
And say what that effect is in your words.
Well, there's multiple effects. One effect is it requires decisions to be based on evidence. In our world today, people reach conclusions and have decisions and make opinions, and they do it without any evidence. Just, well, they saw a 5-second blurb on TV, gut reaction, decision. Not so
well,
in a trial.
As we record this, a week before the election of 2016, sudden FBI revelations that there is another series of emails that may or may not bear on Mrs. Clinton's ethics and so on. Here's a classic case of judgment without evidence.
Correct.
So that the country has been put in an almost impossible situation where there's an implication that something bad is out there, but we have no idea, A, if that's true, or B, what it might be. And yet people drawing conclusions in every possible direction, that's exactly what you're trying to prevent.
Yes. But there's another aspect to the jury trial, too, and that is what Mr. Jefferson referred to, and that is the participation of the citizens. And you have decision makers who are going to make one decision in one isolated case. Therefore, they're not subject to undue influence. They don't have a dog in that fight. They have nothing to gain or nothing to lose by
skewing. In fact, if they do, they're taken off the jury.
Well, we try to, yes. We try to identify that when we're allowed to up front and strike them before they get on a jury.
So you're looking for someone who's not ignorant, but ignorant of the circumstances of the trial.
Right, and who can actually sit and listen to evidence.
And take in the evidence both ways.
Right.
And then make a judgment.
Correct.
What did you think of Jefferson's argument that the jury is a watchdog on misconduct?
That's exactly right. And again, the right to trial by jury is almost always spoken of in terms of the right of the litigants or the parties. But what we don't talk about is the right of citizens to participate in and make decisions in government. And citizens really have very few methods of directly participating in government. One is just speaking, which is a difficult way to get much across. Another, of course, is the right to vote for representatives. But the other one is a right to actually be the decision maker and to execute the laws that we've passed. And so that is where citizens truly have the ability to make this form of government work.
So you're in Texas. How many jury trials have you participated in?
I know it's more than 50.
I'm guessing that it's a bell curve, that there have been times when things have gone terribly wrong under this system and times when it's just like perfect. In an average jury trial, give us some sense of what happens between you and that jury.
Well, I think the way I would respond to that is to watch what happens to jurors. Everybody complains about, I don't want to go to jury duty and blah, blah, blah. But when the jury is selected and they stand up and take the oath, a change overtakes them, and you can see it. And they become very serious. They take it seriously. They want to do the best they can. They pay attention. All the cliches and things we hear about jurors who are just biding their time or complaining, I don't see that very often at all.
They rise to the occasion.
They rise to the occasion.
It deepens their citizenship.
Absolutely. No question about that.
And so this ennobles our system.
It does.
We're talking to Joe Lovell, my favorite attorney from Amarillo at the very heart of the Texas Panhandle, someone who has come on Lewis and Clark trips and other journeys into the American West. What a pleasure to have you in the barn here in the New Enlightenment Radio Network in Bismarck, North Dakota. I know you'll come back to do more programs, but thanks for blessing us today.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.